bravery and optimism, we wouldn't be standing together here. Men and women, black and white, foreign and homegrown, united in a single cause, to take a stand against hate and destruction. Despite my years of practiced cynicism, I felt a real stirring of good old red, white, and blue patriotism. From beside me, Rudy said,
"It's a genuine perspective check, isn't it?"
"Who are?"
Top said softly. "Major Cortland." We turned to see a big man in a beautifully tailored lightweight charcoal suit come striding across the floor, hand out, a smile in his tanned face. I recognized him at once from Grace's description. Lyndon Brierley, Regional Director of the Secret Service. We stepped up to meet him by the podium that had been erected between the display cases. It was a three-step affair, heavy with red, white, and blue bunting and bristling with microphones, none of which were currently turned on. I'd checked. Grace made introductions and offered her hand. Brierley gave it a firm single pump.
"Sorry for borrowing the Secret Service as our cover, sir," she said. "The President thought it would be best under the circumstances."
Brierley didn't miss a beat.
"Sure, sure, I understand," he said,
though he probably didn't like it. I wouldn't if I were in his shoes, but he hadn't gotten this far in his career by letting sour grapes show on his face. He looked around to confirm that there was no one else in the room except Brierley and Echo Team.
"I've met your boss, Mr. Deacon."
He paused and his smile became a bit rueful.
"Or is it Church? There seems to be some disagreement about that."
"He prefers to be called Mr. Church."
"Interesting man," Brierley said. "I tried to run a background check on him and pretty much had my knuckles beaten with a ruler by the Commander-in-Chief."
Grace returned his smile but said nothing, nor did Rudy. I practiced looking like a cigar store Indian. Brierley waited a second, then shrugged.
"Okay, I get it. No problem, Major. So tell me what I can do for you."
Grace and I had agreed that she'd handle Brierley and I'd take Lee, so she dug right in.
"Sir," she said, "we'd like to discuss the candidates you suggested for transfer to the DMS.
That dialed down the wattage of Brierley's smile.
"Why's that, Major?"
Instead of answering, she asked,
"What can you tell me about the men you chose to recommend?"
She recited 11 names, including Sergeant Michael Sanderson, who was one of Dietrich's security men, and Second Lieutenant Oliver Brown. The others I hadn't yet met. I saw Brierley flick a glance across the room at Ollie and then return his gaze to Grace.
"Can you be a bit more specific?"
"Just dotting the I's and crossing the T's," she said with a smile.
"Uh-huh," he said. "And for that you flash a presidential order."
Grace said nothing. Brierley sucked his teeth.
"Okay," he said. "You caught me."
I stiffened, but then he upped the wattage on his smile.
"A couple of my recommendations were entirely self-serving, I'll admit it. Mike Sanderson is the son of an old friend of mine. Mike's career seemed to stall in place after he left the Army and joined the service. We all thought he'd rise like a meteor, but he didn't make the cut to the presidential detail. And when you miss that step, you tend to tread water. I promised his dad I'd look out for him, and the DMS seemed like a chance for a fresh start."
"And Lieutenant Brown?"
Brierley colored.
"Well, that's a little more awkward, and I'm not sure if it's something we should even be talking about."
"Sir, we're here on the orders of the President himself."
Brierley sighed and stared at the empty air between Grace and me for a few seconds, the muscles in the sides of his jaw flexing as he thought it through. We let him. Finally, he said,
"Okay, but it's on your head if this information gets out, because I'll damn sure know that it didn't come from me except right here and right now."
He nodded to himself, the decision made.
Homeland and the service have done a number of ultra-top-secret operations since 9/11. Off-the-books stuff, if you follow me.
"Of course, sir,"
Grace said. I nodded. "A lot of black ops stuff never makes it onto paper. Plausible deniability is easier without a paper trail."
"Ollie was never in Iraq. That, was a cover story. He's been Delta Force for 4 years and has been used in over 20 operations. Extreme stuff. Missions that involve military intelligence, the service, Homeland, and the CIA. But more recently, until he was transferred to the DMS, Lieutenant Brown has officially been a Secret Service agent, but one that we've had out on loan to the company."
We know he's with the CIA, I said. Are you saying he's more than just another one of their spooks? He grunted.
Captain, until I transferred him, he was one of this government's very best operators. Covert ops, infiltration, and special skills. He has the full package.
Brierly looked past me to where the young man was standing foursquare, staring hard in our direction.
And on top of all that, he's the best assassin I've ever seen.
Chapter 98 El Mujahid.
How do I look? The fighter asked. Ahmed turned in his seat and smiled broadly. Perfect. Amira herself would not recognize you.
El Mujahid leaned over and looked at himself one last time in the explorer's rearview mirror. With blue contact lenses, an expert hair dye that gave him wavy red hair, skillfully crafted latex appliances, and makeup that gave him pale skin, and a scattering of freckles, the fighter looked like a raw-boned young Irishman. Salim had even used special tape to change the shape and angle of El Mujahid's nose, giving it a snubbed and up-tilted look. Padding in his gums gave him more prominent cheekbones. Even he could not see the man he was beneath the makeup.
The boy is a wizard, the fighter agreed.
Now, there's one last thing to do before we go, said Ahmed as he took a small case from the glove compartment, unzipped it, and removed a prefilled syringe.
The liquid was a luminous green gold that sparkled in the sunlight.
Roll up your sleeve.
El Mujahid did so and held out his arm. He didn't even wince when Ahmed plunged the needle into his flesh and injected the entire contents into him.
Amira said that the antidote will be at its strongest in 40 minutes, Ahmed said, and advises that you release the plague at that point. She said that you should be completely protected, but also said that once you activate the device, you should get away as quickly as possible.
He drew a breath.
Besides, things will be getting very violent very quickly.
El Mujahid looked at his wristwatch.
Then we had better move.
Ahmed nodded and removed a second syringe from the case and injected himself. He was wearing a Hawaiian shirt with toucans on it and gave himself the shot high on his shoulder where it wouldn't be seen. He put the syringe case back in the glove compartment. He hung a lanyard around his neck to which was clipped a plastic ID holder. It read, Press.
You have only 2 doses?
The fighter asked.
What about your woman, Andrea?
She's a woman. Ahmed spread his hands in a man-of-the-world gesture. We all make sacrifices.
El Mujahid nodded. He had made his own sacrifices to the cause where women were concerned.
There is no God but Allah, Ahmed whispered.
And Muhammad is his prophet, agreed El Mujahid.
Ahmed put the car in gear and drove off. Chapter 99 The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, 11:26 a.m. Brierly told us that he stood behind his decision to send Ollie to us and that he'd stake his reputation on the fact that Ollie was every inch a true American, a phrase he used 3 times.
Look, I have an event to run. The First Lady will be here in a couple of minutes.
Mind if we loiter about, sir?
Asked Grace. He frowned at her.
Am I going to have some trouble here today?
I cut in on that. Wouldn't you agree that since 9/11 there's been a potential for threat at every major national holiday and political event?
Brierly studied me for a 3 count, and then his voice dropped to a less friendly whisper.
Don't fuck with me, Captain. I got a pretty damned cryptic keep-your-eyes-open sort of memo this morning from Washington, but it had 0 details, and I really don't like being kept in the dark. If your team is here because of a specific threat, then I need to know about it, and right goddamn now.
I opened my mouth to reply in kind, but Grace stepped between us and took Brierly by the elbow and led him out of earshot of everyone in the room. They stood with heads bowed together for 3 minutes, and I could see his body becoming more rigid with each passing second. Then he gave a nod and moved toward the door, walking as if his boxers were filled with jagged glass.
"What did you tell him?" I asked when she rejoined me.
"The truth," she said, "or at least as much of it as he needs to know."
He didn't look happy about it.
"Are you?"
"Point taken."
He said he'll quietly increase the circle of protection around the First Lady. He has a number of agents in plain clothes who can be seeded into the crowd at the ceremony.
Good. The more the merrier. Another agent entered the chamber a minute later and hurried over to us, introducing himself as Colby, Brierly's number two.
I've been asked to brief you on the on-site security.
He led us to a staff-only door hidden behind a screen on which the Declaration of Independence was printed.
If we need to remove the First Lady in the event of a crisis, agents will escort her through here and then lock the door behind them. There are offices and other rooms back there, and we have a designated secure spot as well as escape routes.
After he left, I dialed the cell number for Robert Howell Lee, and after verifying that the line was secure, identified myself and read the note from the president that ordered everyone to offer complete and immediate assistance to my investigation. He answered that with a long silence, and I could imagine him trying to figure out what the hell was going on. I hadn't told him. I broke into the silence and asked him if he could meet us in the bell chamber.
What?
You mean now?
He demanded.
Are you out of your mind, Captain? Do you have any idea what is going on?
We can grab a few minutes after the speeches, I interrupted. This won't take long.
Can you at least tell me what the hell this is about?
Grace had returned and she and Rudy were leaning close to eavesdrop on the call. She mouthed the words,
"Play the card, Joe."
So I did. Yes, sir, we are here representing the Department of Military Sciences. I let him digest that. Whether he was guilty or innocent, it was a hell of a bomb to drop, and he had to react.
Jesus Christ, he said.
There was another pause.
All right, give me a few minutes. I'm on the other side of Independence Mall in the communications center, and I have to get someone to cover for me.
He disconnected. I turned to Rudy.
Well? Did he sound spooked to you?
He shrugged.
He sounded harried.
Grace nodded.
Let's face it, we picked a bloody stupid time to come up here.
Can't catch someone off guard if they have time to prepare, Rudy said.
She shrugged and I looked over at my team. Ollie's face was pure hostility, and had been ever since he saw that we were there to interview the man who had sent him to the DMS. He eyed me with that cold shooter's squint, and I gave it right back to him. Skip saw the look passing between us and frowned, and he took a half step back from Ollie, as if afraid to get in the way of something. I noticed that Top, Bunny, and Gus were casually looking from them to me, but nobody said anything. The door behind us opened, and a big man entered. He was dressed in the standard navy blue and red tie of the service. He was every bit as big as Bunny, with thick shoulders, flaming red hair, and an Irish snub nose.
"Who are you?" Dietrich asked sharply, moving to intercept him.
"Special Agent Michael O'Brien,"
the man said in surprise, holding out his ID. He held a metal case in the other hand.
"I was detailed to check the room before the First Lady's party moves in here for the speeches."
Gus checked the ID and called it in while he inspected the metal case. It held the standard electronic scanners and nitrate sniffers that would show if anyone had planted bugs or bombs in the room. Dietrich nodded his approval and handed back the ID. Dietrich closed his phone and sketched a salute to the agent.
"Okay, O'Brien, the room's yours."
Chapter 100 Galt, outside the bunker, July 4th. The rover sat in the lee of a stand of palm trees about 100 yards from the tent that hid the entrance to Amira's bunker.
"Now what, sir?"
asked the driver.
"Is your contact meeting you here?"
"In a way," Galt said. "Toys, would you oblige?"
Without a word, Toys drew his pistol and shot the driver in the back of the head. The impact knocked the man against the steering wheel and splashed the window with bright blood.
"Sorry, old chap," Galt said distractedly.
Toys's face was stone as he removed the clip and replaced the round. He didn't want to come up a bullet short at some crucial moment. He looked at his watch.
"Zeller's team is still 20 minutes out. Where do you want to wait for him? I don't like being this exposed."
Before Galt could answer, the sat phone rang and Toys put it on speaker. For a moment, Galt's heart lifted, hoping that it was Amira. But then the American's voice barked at them.
"Line?"
"Clear, my friend. How are things going?"
The American's voice was shaky.
"God, they're on to me."
"What are you talking about?"
The DMS. They've sent agents here to interview me.
Christ, how did that happen?
I don't know. Sebastian, you have to do something.
Galt almost laughed.
What is it exactly you expect me to do? I'm half a world away.
I have to get out. We haven't been able to find El Mujahid. He could be anywhere, and these agents are right here. Now!
You haven't found him? Galt was stunned. Listen to me. We're paying you too much money for you to let something this important slip through your hands. Fix this.
How? The only way I can bring more assets to bear on this would be to go to my own superiors, and that would land me in federal prison for the rest of my life.
Well, I dare say that getting arrested is going to be the least of your problems, wouldn't you think?
Galt's voice was cold.
What should I do?
Make whatever calls you have to make to let the proper authorities know about the threat. Call the DMS. Tell them that you received an anonymous tip, something like that. Tell them that there is a biological threat. Just for God's sake, don't mention me. And try not to implicate yourself. Maybe they can stop the fighter before he can open the bloody gates of hell. Then get as far away as you can. An island somewhere.
If this thing is released, then an island is the only chance you'll have.
God!
I'm about to clear up my end of things. I suggest you do the same. Be a hero. Save the day.
The American mumbled something that Galt thought was a Hail Mary, and then the line went dead.
Bloody hell, he said, staring out through the blood-stained windshield. The man's a coward and a fool.
You get what you pay for,
Toys said with an irritated sigh. He looked at his watch.
There's still 16 minutes before Zeller's team reaches the bunker. We can't just sit here.
No, agreed Galt.
They got out of the vehicle and drew their pistols. Nothing moved. So they moved quickly and quietly toward the line of tents by the mountain wall. The camp appeared to be deserted. But as they darted from the shelter of one tent to another, they found four corpses lying in a row, their hands and ankles bound, their throats cut. Their blood had soaked into the desert sand, and flies buzzed around them. They were all men on Galt's payroll. Toys snorted.
So much for the element of surprise.
Chapter 101 The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, 11:47 a.m. Special Agent O'Brien completed his sweep of the center, packed his gear back into the metal case, and stowed it under the podium. Lyndon Brierly entered from another door, and with him was a contingent of grim-faced Secret Service agents and at least four members of my old task force. And following them were half the members of Congress, a couple dozen assorted local politicians, and the First Lady and the VP's wife. We faded back against the wall and tried to blend into the woodwork the way the Secret Service are supposed to do. I got some strange looks from my former task force teammates, but no one broke protocol to catch up on old times. Robert Howell Lee had not yet arrived. I looked at Grace, who shrugged.
Give him time, she said,
but there was no time. Brierly, looking stressed and flushed, was trying to guide the ladies to their spots between the two bells, but the women were not cooperating. They were pausing to glad-hand everyone and engage in chit-chat, while outside the press photographers were snapping pictures through the big glass windows. And beyond the press, a veritable sea of people waited for the festivities to commence. Eventually, they let about 200 civilians into the room, which meant that everyone was packed like sardines. I glanced around. Top and Ollie were directly across from where we stood. Bunny and Skip were on my 3 o'clock, and Gus on our 9.
This is going to be a bloody circus,
Grace said under her breath. Brace yourself. I think everyone in a suit is about to make a long-winded speech.
Swell.
The First Lady, looking very stylish in a pretty dress and an absurd hat, mounted the steps to the podium and tapped a microphone, making the usual "Is this on?" remark, which strangely got a laugh. I saw Special Agent O'Brien standing by the far door, slowly scanning the crowd. Our eyes met, and he gave me a single curt nod, and then his eyes shifted away. Weird thing was, he was smiling. I don't think I've ever seen a Secret Service agent smile. Not on the job. As the First Lady launched into her speech, I scanned the crowd looking for Robert Howell Lee, but my eyes kept flicking back to O'Brien. That smile
bothered me.
Chapter 102. Galt, the Bunker. Galt radioed his assault team to let them know he and Toys were proceeding inside.
If you don't hear from us in 10 minutes, come in hard and fast. We'll be there, assured Captain Zeller.
Then Galt and Toys entered the shallow cave that led to the bunker's hatch. They encountered no one, but they weren't fooled, and both men kept their pistols ready. Toys stood guard while Galt accessed the entry keypad that was hidden in the wall. He didn't use the standard code. Amira was too clever for that. Instead, he entered a number sequence that bypassed the security, using a backdoor he'd written into the security software. The new code disabled all external video scanners, including the ones in the cave and the monitors that watched the back door. Zeller's team would now be able to approach unseen. Galt punched in a second code and a door swung open. It wasn't the big airlock that swung open. Instead, to his left, a tall, slender ridge of rock slid upward on silent hydraulics to reveal a narrow passage. No one, not even Amira, knew about this entrance. As the door opened to his command, Galt felt another fragment of his confidence return. There were a number of things Amira didn't know about the bunker. After all, it wasn't really her facility. It belonged to Galt.
Chapter 103. The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, 11:59 a.m.
I leaned close to Grace. Call me paranoid, but I'm getting a weird vibe from that agent over there. I told her where to look, and she glanced surreptitiously at O'Brien, and then flipped open her phone to call in a request for a physical description of Special Agent Michael O'Brien.
"Description matches," she said, but from the expression on her face,
she clearly was getting the same bad feeling.
Into the phone, she said, "Transfer me to Director Brierly's secure channel."
Across the room, I saw Brierly's head swivel around to find us.
"Sir," said Grace, "this may be nothing, but Captain Ledger has some concerns about one of the attending agents. O'Brien, big red-haired bloke by the press entrance."
We watched Brierly turn.
"Michael O'Brien? He's part of the team sent from D.C. Do you want him removed?"
"If you can do it quietly," she said, and I winced.
The Secret Service could do just about anything quietly. The word secret wasn't there for show, but I understood what Grace was doing. She was putting the onus on Brierly to handle something correctly, and we could learn a lot from the way he played it.
"Stand by," he said, and switched channels.
Almost immediately, two of his agents began making their way around the perimeter of the room toward O'Brien. My spider sense was going haywire now. I told Grace to get Brierly back on the line. On the podium, the First Lady launched into a crushingly dull speech that was apparently going to chronicle the history of the Liberty Bell from the moment someone cooked up the idea, minute by minute, to today.
"In 1752, she intoned, "the Pennsylvania Assembly ordered a 2,000-pound bell to place in the steeple of the new State House, what we now call Independence Hall."
One of the approaching agents reached O'Brien and bent to whisper in the man's ear. It must have been couched as a repositioning order, because O'Brien merely nodded and began moving toward the exit, which was directly behind him. The ranks of reporters made it necessary for him to thread his way through, and the two other agents followed.
"He's not bolting," Grace said. "Maybe you're wrong."
"If I am, I'll apologize, but I was still watching O'Brien."
"The order for the bell was sent to the Whitechapel Foundry in England," continued the First Lady. "A noted metalsmith, Thomas Lester, was contracted to cast the first Liberty Bell and to inscribe it with these historic words, 'Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof.' Sadly, that first bell cracked shortly after it was mounted, and a replacement bell was—"
The First Lady kept speaking, but something she had said jolted me as my brain replayed those words. "Noted metalsmith Thomas Lester was contracted to cast the first Liberty Bell."
"And today we will be unveiling a new bell, designed and cast by Andrea Lester, who is with us today."
She indicated a small, unsmiling woman in a yellow pantsuit.
Ms. Lester is the last descendant of the original Bellmaker and is a resident of North Carolina. She is here with us today to help dedicate this new...
My mind was reeling. Rudy must have caught it, too. He turned and was staring wide-eyed at me. He mouthed the word, Bellmaker. Thomas Lester, the metalsmith who made the original Liberty Bell, his descendant, Andrea Lester, maker of the new bell. Lester, the Bellmaker. Holy Christ, Aldine had told us, but he hadn't told us enough. I saw Andrea Lester glance very quickly from the First Lady to the doorway where Agent O'Brien had paused, his hand on the glass door. He turned and looked back into the room, straight at Andrea Lester.
The agents with him put their hands on his upper arms to try to move him along quietly, not wishing to make a scene. I grabbed Grace's arm so hard she flinched in pain and nearly dropped her phone. Grace, oh my God, it isn't Lester Bellmaker, it's Andrea Lester, the Bell Maker. She made the Freedom Bell.
Just as I started moving the First Lady's aides pulled the cords that released the drapes over the Freedom Bell. The red, white, and blue fluttered to the floor. In my mind, the falling colors became a horrible promise of disaster. On the other side of the room, I saw Special Agent Michael O'Brien shrug off the two agents and, his smile, broader than ever, pull a small device out of his pocket. It was a detonator. Chapter 104. Amira, the Bunker. She stood on a metal walkway that circled 20 feet above the main laboratory, watching as her entire staff stood in patient lines, their sleeves rolled up as nurses moved among them to administer injections. Everyone looked so proud. They knew that they were part of something vastly important, that they had contributed something so crucial to the war against the infidel. Amira smiled down at them. One of the nurses flicked a glance up at Amira, and they shared the briefest of smiles. No one noticed that the liquid in the bottle from which she had filled her needles had been the slightest bit different in color, a touch of green, where the others tended more to amber. But the nurse used a nearly opaque white syringe, and she moved very quickly, filling her syringe, injecting, wiping the needle point with alcohol-soaked cotton, drawing more, moving on down the line. Amira glanced down at her own forearm and absently rubbed the injection spot. Black lines had begun radiating out from the needle mark. She was perspiring heavily now, her robes far too hot. Sweat ran down her back and pooled at her waist. She gripped the metal rail to steady herself as the whole room took a sickening sideways lurch.
"Where are you, Sebastian?"
she whispered. On the wall, the clock ticked away the seconds. Chapter 105. The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, noon. Everything froze down to a single white-hot fragment of a second that moved in bizarrely slow motion. The First Lady was leading the applause for the unveiling of the Freedom Bell. Beside her on the podium, Andrea Lester was reaching in her pocket. Grace's phone was falling from her hand as she pulled back the flap of her coat to reach for her gun. Agent O'Brien was starting to raise the detonator. My gun was in my hand. I could hear myself screaming, but I had no idea what I was saying. Every eye in the room was turning toward me. Agents were clawing at their guns. I had no shot at O'Brien. The First Lady was between me and him. On the podium, Andrea Lester was reaching for the President's wife. Something flashed in her hand, and I realized that she had a blade. Not steel, the Secret Service would have caught that, but probably one of the many polymer knives that were nearly as hard as steel and would never trip a metal detector. With a scream of Allah Akbar, she plunged at the First Lady. I shot Andrea Lester twice in the chest. The bullet spun her away from her intended victim, but the polymer knife tore a long gash in the First Lady's sleeve. Everyone started screaming. Panic was immediate and total. I ran forward, grabbing people and hurling them out of my way as I fought to get to the podium where I could get a shot at O'Brien, who had bolted for the podium. The two agents flanking him were already moving. One of them tried to tackle him while the other stepped back and drew his sidearm. Then the crowd surged between us and I lost sight of them. A shattering volley of gunfire erupted from the far side of the podium,
and as I pushed Rudy and the Secretary of the Interior out of my way, I saw that the agent who had drawn his weapon on O'Brien was falling backward, a bullet hole in his temple. The shot hadn't come from O'Brien. It had come to my left. I turned and saw a gun in Ollie Brown's hands, and as I watched, he swung a pistol around and fired two shots, and then the throng hid him from view. Had he shot the agent? It seemed like everyone in the room had a gun, and bullets burned past me. There was too much commotion to tell who was who, and I didn't know how many people in this crowd were Brierly's agents or members of some terrorist hit cell. It was total chaos. I pivoted and started toward O'Brien, but as I located him in the screaming crowd, I saw the second agent go down, blood jutting from a slashed throat. O'Brien moved back toward the podium, the detonator still clutched in his big hand, and suddenly I understood. It was the bell. "Seal the room!" I bellowed as I raised my gun once more. Then I saw out of the corner of my eye that the First Lady was still on the podium. Andrea Lester was down, and one of the First Lady's bodyguards was down. Other agents were rushing the podium, guns drawn, racing to protect the President's wife. Gunfire was coming from every point in the room, and I saw agents in blue blazers shooting at civilians. I saw a man dressed in carnival-patterned shorts standing guard over a pair of congressmen, while nearby, a Secret Service agent was trying to wrestle a plastic handgun from the hand of what looked like a news reporter. I needed to get to the top of the podium so I could see the room and try to see O'Brien so I could stop him before he pushed that button. Grace split off to my left and vanished into the press. I saw a swarm of agents pull the First Lady down and hustle her toward the staff-only door, but in the confusion the wife of the Vice President was still there, nearly lost in the press of congressmen fighting to get away from the gunshots, her agents down and bleeding. Several people were firing now, and I couldn't tell if it was a pitched gun battle or panic shooting. Then I saw an agent mount the steps to protect the VP's wife, but a split second later he staggered and went down, his white shirt front blooming with red. A second agent leaped up, but he also took two in the chest and pirouetted into the crowd. I saw a hand holding a gun pulling back into the crowd. It was bare, no coat sleeve, just a flash of a Hawaiian shirt. One of the tourists? A reporter? Shit, how many of these bastards were in the crowd? Top, I yelled when I saw him fight his way out of a knot of panicking people. It's O'Brien! He nodded and plunged into the crowd again, but there was so much resistance he made no headway. Some of the guests were trying to drop down to the floor to avoid the gunfire, but the storming crowds trampled them. I saw Rudy pushing a group of Girl Scouts into a corner to keep them from getting crushed by the rush of people. There were screams of pain interspersed with the din of the terrified crowd and the constant barrage of gunshots. I heard the distinctive commanding yells of Secret Service agents, but no one was heeding their orders to drop and remain down. I had no idea where Grace or the rest of Echo Team was, and I continued to fight my way toward the podium. The VP's wife was huddled down, arms wrapped around her head, flanked on both sides by dead agents. There were hundreds of people yelling and screaming and fighting to try and get out of the Liberty Bell Center. I caught another flash glimpse of O'Brien. He was still smiling as he raised his hand to bring the detonator up above the level of the crowd. I had no time to think. I launched myself into the air and my shoulder caught the Vice President's wife in the side. I wrapped my arms around her and my momentum carried us off the podium just as Michael O'Brien depressed the button. The Freedom Bell exploded. Chapter 106. Galt, the Bunker. They crouched together in the gloom of a narrow corridor that ran inside the walls of the bunker. LEDs set into the floor cast just enough light so they could pick their way through the darkness.
"Let's split up," Galt suggested. "Go to the rear hatch and make sure Captain Zeller's team can get in. Kill anyone who gets in your way."
"And what are you going to do?"
"I'm going to the lab."
"To do what?" Toys asked, his tone brimming with unspoken accusation. "Remember that we came here to kill her, not to snog and make up."
Anger flared in Galt's chest. "Don't tell me my business," he snapped. "I'm tired of—"
"Tired of what, Sebastian?" Toys cut him off. "Don't try to assert your authority over me at this late date. The time for that passed when you let your girlfriend develop a doomsday weapon."
Galt's pistol was in his hand, the barrel almost but not quite pointed in Toy's direction. His assistant looked down at it, Then with a smile he reached down and pushed the barrel toward him, so that it pointed right at Toys's heart. Toys leaned close, forcing contact with the gun.
"Either kill her or kill me," Toys said calmly.
They stared at each other over the gulf that was opening between them.
"Toys, I..."
Toys pushed the gun aside. He bent forward quickly and kissed Galt on the cheek.
"I love you, Sebastian. You and I are family. Remember that?"
With that, he turned and vanished down the corridor, leaving Galt alone in the dark.
Chapter 107. The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, 12:01 p.m. The outer covering of the Freedom Bell must have been a thin veneer of painted foil that covered hundreds of small ports. Deep inside the bell, in the actual metal of its body, the signal from the detonator ignited countless pockets of highly compressed gas. The whole surface of the bell disintegrated as thousands upon thousands of tiny glass darts were propelled outward with a whoosh of compressed air. No gunpowder, no nitrates. The bell itself was a giant air gun. Each dart was pointed at one end and had walls as thin as spun sugar. Half of them burst as they struck the foil layer on the outside of the bell, and they discharged their contents harmlessly into the air. But the other half, maybe 1,500 darts in all, tore into the flesh of members of Congress and the press, stinging the hands and faces of tourists and local dignitaries and ambassadors from a dozen nations. I could feel the wave of them pass over me as I toppled to the ground with the vice president's wife under me. I had no idea if I'd been hit or not. Everyone was screaming. The VP's wife shrieked in agony as we crashed onto the concrete floor. I rolled off her and spun over into a kneeling shooter's position. How the hell I'd held onto my gun is beyond me, but it was in my hand, and I brought it up, fanning it around to find O'Brien, but he was nowhere in sight. All I could see were legs and torsos as people scattered and stumbled and fell. People kicked me as they ran, and I had to scramble back from being trampled to death. I could hear Grace's voice, high and shrill, ordering the agents in the room to seal the doors. She knew. She understood what we were facing. All of those glass beads fired from the bell were filled with the plague. From her voice I could tell she was every bit as terrified as me. The Saif al-Din had been launched. After all we'd been through, we could lose it all right now if even one of the infected got out. God.
"Echo team!"
I roared, and suddenly Bunny was there, his face white as paste and splashed with blood.
"Are you hit?"
he yelled. "To hell with that, we have to seal the doors."
"It's already done,"
I heard a voice yell with enormous force, and then realized it was Brierly, shouting through the amplification of my ear jack.
"The doors are sealed, I have teams converging to reinforce us from outside."
The crowd hit the glass walls like a wave, and some of the people closest to the doors had to be crushed by the sheer violent mass. There were screams of rage and terror and pain. "I have the VP's wife," I said, "but I can't see the First Lady. Brierly, did she get out?"
"My assistant Colby and a team of agents got her to the safe room," he said. "What the hell is going on, Ledger?"
"I'm on the back side of the podium. Find me," I said. "Now." As I turned to start looking for him, Bunny said,
"Boss, those darts.
I know. Keep an eye out. If anyone starts acting twitchy, you take the shot." I could see how the weight of what we might have to do hurt the big young man, but he nodded. I looked around and saw Rudy still with the Girl Scouts. One of them was bleeding, but from that distance I couldn't tell if it was from the darts or the panic of the crush. "Bunny, stay with the VP's wife," I ordered, "and keep your eyes open for Agent O'Brien. He's our hostile. If you see him, kill him." I gripped his sleeve. "Bunny, did you see who Ollie was shooting at?"
"Negative. Everybody's shooting," he said,
and as if to punctuate his comment, a couple of rounds whined over his head and he flinched. The wild gunfire erupted again and the screams rose to a higher pitch. "Just in case, don't stand in front of him if he has a gun." Bunny turned to me and his eyes searched my face.
"Copy that, boss."
He dropped down into a crouch over the vice president's wife, who was curled into a fetal ball, her face knotted with pain. Three Secret Service agents converged on him and together they formed a protective ring. I got to my feet and saw Top and Ollie racing toward one of the doors. They were working together to prevent the crowds from getting out. Grace was already blocking the other door, her pistol out. I saw Gus Dietrich bent over the governor of Pennsylvania, who was covered with blood. Dietrich was sheltering him with his own body, and he had a smoking pistol in his hand.
On the floor beside him was a Secret Service agent who had taken the blast of the glass darts full in the face. I met Dietrich's eyes for a second, and we exchanged the briefest of nods. I was conscious of the fact that several of the TV cameramen were still on their feet, their cameras mounted on their shoulders. How the hell they had kept their heads was beyond me, and I could only imagine how half the country was reacting to this. I hoped the networks had blacked it out. I saw Brierly and grabbed him by the shoulder and pulled him against the podium. There were no more gunshots, but the air was still torn by screams and yells. We had to bend close and shout in each other's ear. "Why the hell did you shoot that woman?" he demanded, and I was conscious of the fact that his pistol was half-turned toward me. I batted it aside. "Andrea Lester was a traitor and a terrorist sympathizer. She rigged her own bell to fire those darts." I pulled him closer. "She's working with El Mujahid, and your agent O'Brien is one of them. He set off the device." That hit him hard. "My God, we screened her. She was cleared to be here. These guys must have had inside help. Trust no one right now." "Inside, no time for that. Listen to me and listen close. The darts from the bell, they contain the infectious agent Grace told you about. You know, Ebola, this is 100 times worse." I pulled his ear to within an inch of my mouth. "If one single person gets out of this room, we'll have a worldwide plague on our hands. There is no cure." I said that slowly, punctuating each word. "Believe it." Brierly's face twisted into a mask of such utter horror that I thought he was going to scream. Then he ducked as bullets struck the plastic walls around the Liberty Bell. I turned and saw someone dressed like a Philly cop pointing his pistol at us. He fired again, and I pushed Brierly out of the way and returned fire. The fake cop pitched back. I said, "Contact your men outside. Nobody leaves this building. Nobody. We're going to need troops and a Class A biohazard team." He licked his lips, blinking several times as the devastating news sank in, and then I saw the man behind the bureaucrat take over.
"Christ, I hope you're wrong about this, Ledger."
"I wish I was," I said, "but I'm not." Brierly tapped his mic and began rapping out a series of curt commands. He ordered that all teams seal and defend every exit in the building, and he reinforced that to include exits that led off from the offices and rooms beyond the staff only. "Hummingbird is to be located and secured." Hummingbird was the code name for the First Lady. Junebug was the VP's wife. When he got confirmations, he turned to me. "Okay, the First Lady is in the safe room. The VP's wife is being guarded by one of your men and three of my agents. We'll move her to the safe room in a bit." He looked marginally relieved. "Brierly, you need to make sure everyone understands that we can't let anyone out of here, not even the president's wife." He stared at me, torn by his responsibility to protect his charges and the greater reality of the plague. Finally, he nodded and keyed his mic. "This is Director Lyndon Brierly. This is an all-stations alert. On presidential orders, no one is to leave this building. No exceptions. Repeat and confirm." All posts confirmed, but I could imagine a lot of them were either scratching their heads or getting really spooked. "You'd better be right about this." I left him to his job and went to try and find O'Brien, but I couldn't see him anywhere. The gunfire was dwindling now, just sporadic shots interspersed with yells and screams. Movement to my right made me turn, and Grace was there, with Top right behind her, both with guns drawn. Grace had blood on her clothes. But when she saw my expression, she glanced down at her clothes, then met my eyes. She shook her head. "There was a young woman standing right in front of me," she said, and left it there. The gunfire stopped, but the crowd was still surging back and forth like frightened animals in a pen. "Grace, we have to calm these people down." "I'm on it," she said, and spun off, calling to Top and Dietrich, and soon they were moving like bulls through the crowd, shoving people back, yelling orders to everyone, grabbing Secret Service agents and putting them to work. Skip Tyler was near the back wall, reloading his gun. "Skip," I said as I rushed over, "help me find O'Brien." "The red-haired guy? He went through there a second ago." He pointed to the staff-only door that was tucked into a corner. We raced over, but the door was locked from the other side. "You sure he went this way?" "Yeah, him and Ollie followed a whole bunch of Secret Service agents who were hustling the First Lady into the safe room." He looked confused. "That was the protocol, right?"
"Son of a bitch," I snarled and kicked the door in. "Skip, guard this door. Get Grace or Top to give me some backup. But nobody else gets in, you hear me? Nobody. I'm counting on you to hold this line." The young sailor gave me a serious nod and took up a defensive stance.
You got it, Captain.
I ran through the doorway.
Chapter 108. Galt and Amira, the Bunker. Galt opened a slit in a wall panel and peered through it and almost gasped. Amira was not 5 feet from him. Below her, the nurses had nearly completed the injections. He steeled himself and aimed his pistol through the gap and put the red dot of his laser, light as a whisper, onto Amira's back, right between her shoulders. One shot from this distance would punch through her spine, tear through her heart, and burst from between her breasts to leave a gaping red hole the size of a golf ball. One flex of his finger, and the traitorous bitch would be dead. He could do it. He knew he could.
"Damn you, Amira,"
he said, and without meaning to, he mentally added,
"My love."
Tears jeweled his vision, warping her with prismatic distortion. The barrel of the pistol wavered. His assault team would be entering the cave any moment, and Toys would lead them here. Galt shivered, partly at the thought of the firestorm Captain Zeller would be unleashing here in the bunker, and partly at the thought of Toys's transformation. Had his assistant actually changed that much? Or had Galt been blind all these years to the scorpion he kept by his side? The seconds ticked away. Soon the whole bunker would be a hell of bullets and blood. Soon everyone would be dead. Amira, too, whether he killed her himself or not. His orders to Zeller had been specific. Kill everyone. No exceptions.
Amira. God.
Tears broke and rolled down his cheeks, and before he could stop it, a single, heartbroken sob escaped his throat. He saw Amira stiffen, but she did not turn, and Galt forced his hands to steady to hold the red pinprick of the laser sight on her back.
Be a fucking man, he snarled inwardly.
Amira. And then she spoke. Sebastian, she said.
Amira turned without haste to face him. Her head was bowed, looking down to see the red laser dot on her chest, wavering right over her heart. She raised her head, slowly. Galt felt a cold hand reach into his own chest and squeeze his heart to a tiny block of ice. Amira's eyes were wide and glassy, bright with fever. She reached a hand up to the front of her chadri, gathered the black cloth in her fingers, and slowly pulled the scarf down to reveal her smiling mouth. Her lovely olive skin had paled to a sickly sand color, almost gray, and her full lips were stained with fresh blood.
"Sebastian,"
she said softly, as her lips peeled back from her teeth in a snarl of vicious, animal hunger.
"My God,"
Galt recoiled in horror.
"What have you done?"
Amira advanced toward the wall, and even through the narrow opening of the observation slit he could smell her, a fetid, rotting meat stink that rolled off her like the perfume of hell.
"Saif al-Din,"
she whispered, leaning to peer in through the slit.
"You're infected."
His gun hand was shaking so bad that he almost dropped the weapon. Sweat burst from his pores, and his pulse snapped like firecrackers.
"What have you done?"
he asked again in a terrified whisper. She shook her head, still smiling.
"No, Sebastian. I'm not infected. I'm reborn. I'm more alive now than I ever imagined."
"This will kill you."
She shook her head again.
"The pathogen is no longer fatal. I've perfected it. You only saw Generation 7,
she giggled.
"That one scared you, Sebastian. You almost screamed like a woman."
Amira wiped drool from her lips.
"By now my lovely El Mujahid should have launched Generation 10 on the American people. They will be dying soon, Sebastian. All of them. Saif al-Din is so quick."
She snapped her fingers in front of the slot and Galt jumped.
"Generation 10! You're insane."
"I'm immortal," she countered. "You see, we had a breakthrough, Sebastian. I've been working so hard for so long, and you thought we were plodding along with Generation 3, but oh, Generation 10 is immediate. The body reanimates immediately, no lag time, no time to quarantine the infected. Generation 10 is the perfect plague.
Perfect.
The word was like bile in his mouth. She ignored him, totally rapt by her discoveries.
But we went further still. Generation 11 was a disappointment, but oh, Generation 12.
She drew the word out, filling it with wonder and with threat.
We broke through into an entirely new area of science. It's what I've been laboring on for the last year while you left me here in this bunker. The killer pathogen was developed to Generation 10 before you even knew of the second generation.
She laughed at the look of shocked hurt on his face.
We had the plague, but we couldn't use it until we had the cure, and now... Oh, Sebastian, it's a fire in my blood. I can feel it moving through me.
You used it on yourself? You've turned yourself into one of those damned monsters.
Do I look like a monster?
She said. She stepped back from the slot and cupped her breasts through her robes.
Do you think I'm a monster, Sebastian?
God.
Amira's face instantly changed, and she whipped her hands away from her breasts and slapped them against the wall on either side of the slot. It was like an entirely different personality had shoved itself into place behind her dark eyes.
God! How dare you even mention him? Your god is money, you worthless piece of shit!
Galt recoiled and raised the pistol.
You don't even understand what it means to worship God. You couldn't know, Sebastian, what it feels like to feel him in every thought, every breath, to hear his words flowing over the desert sands. You pretended to read the writings of the prophet to fool El Mujahid, but you lacked even the depth of understanding to let those words enter your soul. You think you made me into your whore? Do you think that I would truly betray my husband, my people, my faith, for you?
She spat at him and he dodged away, terrified of what might be in that sputum. He swung the pistol up and put the dot of the laser sight on her forehead where it glowed like an Indian bindi.
I loved you,
he said weakly. And then his mind replayed those words and he realized that he had said loved, not love. It nearly broke him. In his mind's eye, he saw himself turning away from her and bringing the barrel of his pistol up to his own temple. Better to snuff out that loss than endure its absence. But although his hands trembled, the gun did not move. Amira ignored it.
Have you figured it out yet? You must have, or why else would you be here?
Sebastian!
She was using his name like a whip, and each time it stung him.
You think you've found us? But we had been looking for you for years. Not specifically you, you're just not that important. No, we were looking for any faithless, greedy dog who had the resources you have. It was so easy.
She laughed and shook her head, delighting in the pain she caused him.
It was so easy to lure you with covert hints through your network of spies, to draw you to us step by step, to stage things so that you always felt that you were in control, when all the time this was a plan my husband and I had made. Yes, my husband, El Mujahid, the greatest of God's warriors on earth, a true soldier of the faith, a man who lives the words of the prophet every minute of every day.
But you... We...
She spat again, but this time on the floor.
What? We made love? Is that what you were going to say?
Her voice made the words intensely ugly.
I'm not a man, Sebastian. I can't go into battle with guns and knives like my husband and his soldiers. I am a woman, and I am forced to use other weapons, no matter how utterly disgusting and humiliating it has been to open my body to you.
No! Galt snapped back, anger flaring. I know you loved me. I know!
He saw the mad look in her eyes flicker, and for a second that other personality, the dreamy one, seemed to drift back, and Galt knew for sure, that he saw the fires of love still there. Or maybe it was only the embers. for in the next moment the hard and murderous personality re-emerged.
"Each day I get down on my knees to beg forgiveness from Allah for what I have done. Even though it is his will and serves his ends, you made me a whore in the eyes of God, Sebastian. How many deaths does that earn you?"
Behind Amira there was a strange sound. The gathered scientists and technicians were all jabbering, loudly. Some in shocked protest, others in fury. Amira stepped back to allow Galt to see what was happening.
"They think we have an antidote,"
she said softly, as below more than two-thirds of the crowd were sinking down to their knees or collapsing onto tables.
"They think we are all safe from Saif al-Din."
"What have you done?"
She turned to him.
"I gave my best people. A few fighters, a few scientists. Generation 12. Like me."
She raised her arm and pulled back her sleeve to show the needle mark on her arm. From the dark pinprick, black lines of infection radiated out like a dark spiderweb.
"You've killed your own people."
"Oh, no, not all. The rest of them were given Generation 10, and soon I'll open the bunker doors and they'll spread out across Arabia like the plague they are. The great Satan does not have enough bullets to stop the waves of them that will come."
"You're insane. You've doomed us all."
But Amira shook her head.
"No. Generation 12 is different. We don't die like they do. We ascend. I've already ascended. I died without dying, Sebastian. But I suffered no brain death, no loss of brain or motor function, no loss of intellect. I am me. Amira, scientist, wife of El Mujahid, loyal handmaiden to Allah, a servant of the word of the Prophet. But now I cannot ever die. I've been reborn, you see. Saif al-Din has cut through me like a purifying scythe. My sins, my earthly attachments have been carved away by the sword of the faithful. What remains is pure. What remains is the instrument of God on earth."
"Oh, Amira, my princess,"
Galt murmured, tears cascading down his cheeks.
"What have you done? What have you done?"
"Beginning today, thousands of doses of Generation 12 will be sent from here to those fighters who have proven their faith. Once they have ascended, they will share the gift with their families and their most trusted friends, and then we will sit back and watch the rest of the godless world devour itself."
"I won't let you."
Amira reached out to grasp the lip of the observation slit. She pulled herself close and whispered like a child, conveying a great secret.
"I know everything about the bunker, Sebastian. Everything. I know all your secrets."
Galt stared at her, puzzled. And then he heard the low scuff of shambling feet in the darkness of the corridor behind him. Chapter 109. The Liberty Bell Center, Saturday, July 4th, 12:04 p.m. As soon as I was inside, the sound of chaos diminished, and I crept into a long, darkened corridor that led, I knew, into a maze of offices and workrooms. The center wasn't that big, but there were still 100 places someone could hide. I moved forward through several rooms, encountering one locked door after another. It would be suicide to kick each door. But these were interior locks, and I could trip most of them with a stiff piece of plastic. I used my Barnes & Noble member card. It was slow going, searching and clearing every room without backup. I wondered what was taking Skip so damn long to send someone after me. I was hoping that O'Brien and Ollie had tried to make a run at the First Lady and had been cut down by Colby and his team. Agents on the presidential detail are incredibly tough and resourceful. But with every step, my hopes diminished. I didn't know who or what O'Brien was, but if Brierly was right and Ollie was a top CIA killer, then this was exactly his sort of operation, a hunt and kill. What confused me was the fact that Brierly did not seem to be our man. Having spoken with him and seen him in action, I could not believe that he was any part of the chaos back in the hall. And yet, Ollie had been with O'Brien, and someone had fired those shots that saved O'Brien. Very accurate shooting in a hysterical situation, which showed professional calm. I stopped when I saw a splash of blood on the floor. Very fresh. Creeping forward, I found more.
and then a place where feet had scuffed in the blood, two sets of shoes. A scuffle? Had someone else come in following O'Brien and Ollie and been ambushed by them, or had the two traitors had a falling out? Then it occurred to me that one of them might have been